Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up in today's show, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Paul Muldoon and historian Dr. Eamon Phoenix on history being made yesterday in the North and what the row over the RIC commemoration tells us about ourselves. Also today, we chat to Druid Theatre's Gary Hines on the first Tom Murphy production since his death, legendary Scottish songstress Barbara Dixon on going back to her roots, and we'll have some great live music from singer-songwriter David Keenan. Our text number is 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie. You can find us on Twitter at Miriam O'Call. Good morning, David Keenan.
Good morning, Miriam. Thanks so much
for being here. And you're here accompanied today by Gareth Quinn Redmond on violin and Harry Hoban on keyboard. We'll have a chat in a moment about your new album and your concert tomorrow night in the Olympia. But you're going to start off with one of your songs called James Dean.
James Dean.
Off you go.
Yeah.
It stabbed me in the chest like the pimp Prudence knife. It's a poor Samuel Beckett under mother of pear sky. The back of the wall I bawled, cursing all real and rhyme, while feeling out of sorts like a road sweeper dressed up to the nines as the multicolored kite over shoulders taking flight. And the local matadori gives two fingers to the girl next door. I had a dream James Dean was alive and well today, looking for the quiet life, working for Irish Rail. And in me father's clothes with a bloody nose, I sang as in its own sweet. There by the slot machine, there's James Dean, it pulled beneath my feet. Then you disciples of the street, you all burst in through open doors, and the creaking of the chairs and the running down the stairs, pure ecstasy. The circus master smiles, pointing his finger at the mime. I hear a distant call of a boy named Paul, who was taken before his time. And all the precious stones of the mongrel's born entice me, you silly child, you just run on home, for your tea's gone cold and your mother, she cursed you blind. And the back door man feels wrong for switching off when signing on, and the double-jointed teeth wins an award for pure indecency. I had a dream James Dean was alive and well today, looking for the quiet life, working for Irish Rail. And in me father's clothes with a bloody nose, I sang as in its own sweet. There by the slot machine, there's James Dean, that cold beneath my feet. Then you disciples of the street, you all burst into open doors, and the creaking of the chairs and the running down the stairs, pure ecstasy. I had a dream James Dean was alive and well today, working for Irish Rail.
Thanks so much, David, for that. Now, listen, your new album, your debut album, A Beginner's Guide to Bravery, I think it was released on Friday. It got great reviews. Some saying it was called devastatingly good.
Oh, there you go.
But that must be nice to get.
It's a nice thing. It's a nice thing. But, you know, praise and criticism are kissing cousins, you know. So it's dangerous to pay too much attention to it. But, I mean, there was a sense of achievement and pride in putting the record out into the world and everything that it took to get to the position to record it and release it. A sense of gratitude, but now it's time to move on into the next thing. you know.
Yeah. Mind, it's only last Friday, really. Well, so I think you can give yourself a little bit of a break.
Yeah. Well, look, the Olympia on Monday or tomorrow is a culmination of so much. And
tell us about that. It's on tomorrow night in the Olympia, isn't it, you're playing?
It is, yeah. You know, living in Dublin for a few years, finding a tribe, feeling connected to something, to a city and a place, and trying to manifest and visualise maybe a gathering in there. And although I've supported people a couple of times in there, to hold our own happening, it's a beautiful thing. And there's a lot of moving parts. And, you know, it's only going to happen the first time, and I intend to kind of elongate it as much as we can. It'll have to drag us out.
And anyone who wants to go, it's ticketmaster.ie, isn't it, for tomorrow night?
I think it's sold out.
It's sold out?
It's sold out, yeah. It's sold out.
Well done you, David Keenan. You were in Belfast last night. Good night to be in Belfast.
Yeah. Oh, it was beautiful. The Empire Ballroom.
Yeah, it's a beautiful venue.
Beautiful venue there. Mm. And the crowd were incredibly generous, you know, so.
You're going to sing another of your songs for us now. What are you going to sing?
Yeah, Tin Pan Alley.
Okay, well, look, David, I wish you the very best of luck. Thanks to you both, you and Gareth Quinn Redmond and Violin, Harry Hoban and Kiki Bird. I wish you the very best of luck going forward. And thanks for coming in to us on this Sunday morning. Thank you.
Just across from my old street, there's a place called Tin Pan Alley, where I've wandered many nights, first when many moons ago. As I walk among its ruins, among its broken, battered brickwork, standing proud and pouring rain against any punch-drunk sky, I do roam, welcoming the wee small hours, my reflection in the window, those shadows cast on cobblestone. I do roam, in your footsteps smoking in the cold, wheat breeds been tainted, clinging to the leaves, those songs of old. Songs of old. Just across from my old street, there's a place called Tin Pan Alley, where many souls still dwell, remnants of the last great scene. I met a man there on the corner, he was picking flowers by the roadside. Said he was a household name during the last days of Rome. Then a voice came from the cover. Yeah, brother, I've one arm as long as the other. Won't you tell me, should I repent all of my sins? For I grow old, I wear the bottoms of me trousers rolled. Give me your hand, dance with me again before I go. Let us roam, welcoming the wee small hours, our reflection in the windows, those shadows cast on cobblestone. Let us roam, in their footsteps smoking in the cold air, we breathe been tainted, clinging to the leaves, those songs of old. Those songs of old, clinging to the leaves, songs of old.
Oh, thank you so much, David. I'll just bring lots of reaction too. I saw David Keenan play in the Roisin Dove in Galway just before Christmas. My brother got the tickets. I hadn't heard of David's music before. He blew us all away. His music and presence on stage is incredible. Watch this space, A Star is Born. That's from Maureen Nicanumra. And one more says, listening in now from Ballymena in County Antrim, we are one island, to the amazing David Keenan. A very special gig last night in Belfast. Well done. His new album is superb. A Beginner's Guide to Bravery. That's from George Lorimer. Thanks so much, David, and thanks to you all. Best of luck in the future. Good luck tomorrow night in the Olympia. Enjoy yourselves. Meanwhile, I have been joined in studio by the great Gary Hines. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. How are
you? Look, as to remind my listeners, it was way back in 1975 when, of course, Druid Theatre Company was set up by three of you, three young, idealistic and enthusiastic theatre obsessive. Yourself, Mary Mullen and Mick Lally, of course. Gary, when you went on to be the first woman to win a Tony Award, you brought Druid to practically every parish in this country, as well as to New York, London and all over the world. And this month, you're back with a new version of Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard by your close friend and collaborator, the late Tom Murphy.
That's correct.
Thanks so much for coming in, Gary. Is it more difficult putting on a play when Tom is no longer here?
Well, it's going to be very difficult on a personal level for us, because it'll be the first time we won't have his presence in the rehearsal room, his actual presence in the rehearsal room. The thing about it, I suppose, is that, you know, he is so steeped into all of us and to a lot of the, you know, the actors, a lot of the actors in the Cherry Orchard would have worked with him before. That really, in a sense, he will be there with us. And, you know, even we had a reading of the Cherry Orchard about 3 months ago. And it was actually quite extraordinary, because when, you know, the play obviously is by Chekhov, but it's Tom's version of it, adaptation of it. And it's Tom's language, it's Tom's world. Mm. And you could just feel his presence in the rehearsal room as we read it. So I'm sure that's going to continue through the rehearsal period.
And I know, of course, it's going to be at the Black Box Theatre in Galway from the 22nd of February to the 7th of March. And then it's going to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre here in Dublin from the 8th to the 11th of April. Tell people about it, though, because what does Tom do with the play?
Well, the play, obviously, the original play is Russian. Mm. And it concerns the return of the owner of this estate. She has lived in Paris for 5 or 6 years. She's back after a broken relationship. And she returns to meet a kind of chaos and an absolute clarity that the estate is no longer capable of sustaining the amount of people that it does. And she's urged to sell. And she doesn't listen. We don't even know why she doesn't listen or why. But she doesn't, and the estate is bought out by effectively her servant, or the son of her servant. So the play is about change. But Chekhov, you know, was an extraordinary voice in the theatre. I mean, without him, the kind of thing that we accept as modern theatre wouldn't have happened. It's that he could write the sense of real people, real three-dimensional people. Before that, theatre tended to be about characters who were far away and did big actions. Chekhov, somehow or other, in a word or two lines from a character, seems to sketch out a whole life. And like, people come on stage, say very little or do very little of any significance, but you feel like you've known them all your lives. And then Tom puts his voice. So it's still set in Russia, but it's using Tom's language and it's in Tom's voice.
And his brilliant language and his voice. Because I've spoken to you before when Tom was alive, of course. Didn't you commission Balla Gongora, did you?
We did. Well, I wouldn't say we commissioned Balla Gongora, but essentially in the 80s we were looking to work with a professional established writer. And Tom was the obvious person because of his success at that time. He was, you know, basically one of the national writers. And it took a while to persuade him, but he became writer in association for a few years. And the deal was that we would do one of his already written plays and that he would write a new play. And the new play that emerged was Balla Gongora.
And you've also, of course, produced his Conversations on a Homecoming in the Sheely. Do you? Is it impossible? It's like saying a favourite child. Do you have a favourite play of Tom's?
It's absolutely impossible. It is like saying a favourite child. But Conversations is very particular, all right, because essentially how it came about when we... I asked him, was there any play that he had that he wished to go back to again? And he said that there is a play called The White House. One act is set in 1963, the next act is set in 1973. And I have never been sure whether it's the 73 act should start it or the 63 act should start it. And they, apparently in the Abbey Run, they actually switched over and changed it. But he never got sort of satisfied. So he started thinking about it all again. And gradually it emerged that actually he didn't need one of the acts. He didn't need the 63 act. So he changed the beginnings of the 73 act, and it became its original act title, a play called Conversations on a Homecoming. Mm. And it went on to be one of the most popular productions ever in Druid's repertoire.
Yeah, such a beautiful play. Interestingly, you've teamed up, haven't you, Gary, with Elman Pictures, so people can see this play in their local cinema. Explain that.
Well, essentially what we're doing here is we're live streaming on the 5th of March as the audience in Galway in the Black Box sit and watch. The play will actually be being live streamed into cinemas all over Ireland and abroad. An Element are distributor and collaborator on this. So it's great. It's a big step for us, and it means that we can pursue our strategy, which is always to try and reach new audiences all the time. And this is the first to do it in this manner.
Remind people, Gary, I mean, you've been directing, you've been running Druid now for more than 40 years. You grew up, was a balladurina, County Roscommon?
That's right, I was born. That was my mother's home place, and my father met my mother and there. And we lived there for about, I was six then. We moved to Monaghan and then finally to Galway, which had been the family's hope always to go back to Galway, which is my father's home place.
And where did the love of theatre, where did the creativity come from in your family?
I have no idea. I know that, you know, I was in fifth class in the Louis Convent, and for some reason or other, I decided I wanted to do a play, and I did. My teacher, Sister Josephine, allowed me to do, and I'd like to say hello to Sister Josephine, because she's...
Great.
She's out in Kiltipper. She may not be listening, but she's out there. She's celebrated. She's 102, 101 years old.
Wow.
And it's fabulous to have a relationship with her. She's a great, great woman. So that's the first time I did a play. And then I sort of got, did a little bit in secondary school, but it was then when I went into UCG. And that's what my 4 years in UCG became about. Doing plays. I studied, crammed just enough to scrape through the degree. And then Druid came after that. So,
and that incredible friendship, of course, with Mick and Mary.
Absolutely. I mean, Mick was 2 or 3 years, well, 4 years maybe older than us. Marie and I met in college. Mm. But when we decided to start Druid, we said the only way we'll do it is this Mick Lally. This famous McLally, as he was even then, and leading actor in the Tyvek, if he joins us. And Mick had been going to work on the building sites in London that summer of 75. And he said, all right, I'll change my mind. I won't. I'll throw in my lot with the for the summer. And then the rest is sort of, history. He left his job as a teacher, a vocational teacher. And so Druid was born.
Did you think Druid would last? I mean, what was your plan for Druid?
Look, a plan for Druid was to be alive tomorrow. I mean, that was the biggest plan we had. We had ambitions. Did I think it would last? Did I think I'd be sitting here this morning, sort of 45 years, not in a million thousand years. You know, no act of the imagination could have. But it was just, I think there was a very strong bonding around what we wanted to do, what we didn't want to do. And so that and the collaborations with actors, designers, the group of people that have formed and reformed around Druid, that's really what it's been all about. And obviously that in the context of Galway, the west of Ireland, and of our audiences there.
And of course, yeah, you've grown up with Galway. The city has grown with you. I mean, that link between Druid and Galway, it's pretty indelible, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you couldn't conceive of it outside of, you know, outside of the west of Ireland. And I don't know how even the... It's like it informs us. It's you know, for instance, our project for Galway 2020 will be something which we're calling quite simply the Galway Tour. And the illustration which we're using at the moment is Maureen Mullen standing on a stone wall. And it's basically we're going to go into every corner of Galway County and we're going to make a series of one acts and perform them. So we're going to actually rehearse and perform in the community. So we're going to be going to places like Ballygar, Clifton, Inishman, Inishboffin for the first time. And we're actually going to be, to use a horrible American military word, even we're embedded in the communities before bringing the players all back into the McLally Theatre for the Galway International Arts Festival next year.
Are you excited now about Galway 2020?
Oh, very, very excited for this project and for Galway 2020 generally. I mean, you know, there's such a huge programme just going through and it's going to be extraordinary to get the opportunity to see so much and to have so many, not just of the kind of projects that have been dreamed up by all the various Galway organisations, because everybody is sort of pulling out all the stops, but also to be able to invite international artists in. So it's going to be a great year, yeah.
You had so many highs, Gary, in Druid. I mean, the Tony Award I mentioned, but also stuff like performing an Inishman in the middle of a storm. Do you have a favourite high moment yourself? Or,
well, as you said, it's like children. I mean, I've been lucky. There's been so many highs, it's hard to pick. But I have mentioned one of them in the sense that we were to perform all of Singh's six plays in the dune, in the fort, in the outdoors. And unfortunately, we didn't account for the weather. And the weather was terrible and we had to retreat into the hall. And we kept an eye on the weather all day. It wasn't getting any better. But we eventually decided that for the last play, Deirdre of the Sorrows, I came out to the audience and said, we're prepared to go up to the dune. It's still raining, but we have the fire barrels. We have the light. We're prepared to do it if you're prepared to put on your rain gear and come up with us. And they said, of course we are. So we transported the entire company, the entire audience, which is about the same size, up to the dune. And it was extraordinary. It was absolutely extraordinary. McLally was playing the king, and as part of his performance, he had to lean on two sticks. And when he came out and put the two sticks into the ground, I became so grateful, because I thought if he didn't have those sticks, he was going to be blown
away
up over the walls and out into the Atlantic, never to be seen again.
You've toured Ireland consistently as a company and you often play small venues.
Yeah.
Why do you do that? And do you think that's important to do?
I think it's really important. And that's why this, you know, Galway 2020 project is going to be so great, because it's, I don't know, there's... that you become part of that community for the period of time you're there. First of all, your audience tends to range from young people right up to old people. There's a sense of event and welcome when you tour. You get to know your audience in a way that is not necessarily always possible when you're touring to sort of professionally run venues and so on. So we've been doing what Pauline McLean long ago dubbed unusual rural touring art. And we've been doing these kind of tours since way back in the 80s, and they remain something that's, you know, deep in our DNA.
Is it a struggle at times to keep a theatre going like Druid?
It's a struggle all the time. I mean, people don't believe me when I say that. My sense of the struggle to keep Druid going is not much different now from what was 20 or 25 years ago. Time doesn't give you the luxury of any sense of permanence. We are constantly struggling each year to make theatre anew, to make it work.
Does that ever wear you down?
Sometimes. Yeah, of course it does. And I think it wears, I don't think we realise the, well, what I call it is the hidden subsidy that's made by people who work in theatre, to theatre itself, wherever, whether it's in Druid or elsewhere, but also the cost. I mean, there is a cost. You know, in one sense, you're celebrated, and rightly so. But in another sense, people are sort of waking up to not know where their next job is coming from. They have no security, or the great majority of them have no security. And it's a struggle. And I think it's really important to remember that.
One of our listeners says, Miriam, it's from Rita. I remember, Gary, when you were 8 years old, like myself, in St. Louis Convent, where you were so confident in front of Sister Breda. I was in awe of you and I knew you would be a star.
I was so in awe of Sister Breda myself. I was terrified of her. Yeah, she was in sixth class.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. I love that about live radio, though, that people...
It's great.
Hi to you,
great
Rita.
Great to hear from.
Well, look, just to say, Gary, first of all, thanks so much for coming in and chatting to me this morning. The Cherry Orchard by Chekhov, which is obviously in a version by Tom Murphy, is going to be at the Black Box Theatre Galway from the 22nd of February to the 7th of March.
Yep.
And here in the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin from the 8th to the 11th of April. Tickets from Ticketmaster.ie.
Yep.
And it, of course, it'll be shown in the cinemas, as we said, as well, and that link up with Elman.
That's right, and in the Bord Gáis Theatre. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Fantastic. Gary Hines, keep doing all your brilliant work. Keep going.
Thanks very much, Miriam.
Thanks so much.
Honoured to be on your show.
Yeah, no, my privilege.
I hear that wonderful music there.
Yeah, it was great. Absolutely, David Keenan. Yeah. Thanks so much, Gary. We'll take a break.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie and you can find us on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. Well, many of you will know Barbara Dixon for her chart-topping power ballads, I Know Him So Well, and other songs including Another Suitcase in Another Hall and January, February. But after 17 gold and platinum albums and winning Olivier Awards for her roles in musical theatre and acting on television in Band of Gold, Barbara Dixon has also kept her folk music roots going, and this month she'll be here in Dublin as part of Tradfest, and she joins me now from the BBC studio in Edinburgh. Good morning, Barbara Dixon.
Good morning, and good morning from Edinburgh, my beloved city.
And it is a beautiful city.
It is, and so is Dublin, of course. I'm very familiar with Dublin. I've been coming to Ireland since I was 17 years old, and that's a long time ago.
That's wonderful. Now, listen, folk music was always your first love. I mean, despite the mega hits I mentioned there. Tell me about it. You started, I think, Barbara, in Scottish folk music with kind of people like Gerry Rafferty and Billy Connolly. What do you remember from that time?
Well, actually, I was just thinking as I was waiting to talk to you that I actually came to Dublin in 1964 with a friend of mine to sort of check out the music scene in Dublin. Already at that time, as a school child, I mean, I'd just left school, I was very interested in folk music. There was a folk revival in the UK. I'm not sure it happened the same way in Ireland, oddly enough, but over here it certainly did. There were folk clubs. So people didn't tend to play in bars so much. They played in folk clubs. Once a week, people would gather like any other club. And I went to a local club, age 16, in Dunfermline, in my hometown in Fife. And I learned from watching people like Archie Fisher, who actually has his 80th birthday concert at Celtic Connections this week. There's another wee connection there. But I learned a lot of songs from a book called 101 Scottish Songs, which I was given as a prize at school. And I was deeply immersed in folk music, and the I Know Him So Well image that people have of me is a role. It was a role in the theatre. I didn't play it in the theatre, but the video of it was done like a role in the theatre. So I'm a musician, basically. I play the guitar and I play piano and I sing and write songs and do traditional songs, and that's what I've done all the time. Even when I was a pop star, I used to sing an a cappella pipe lament from Scotland as part of my show in Act Two. I would drape myself in a black cloak and sing this lament from Skye. So it's totally in my DNA.
And you have strong working class roots, don't you? I think your dad, did he work in the dockyard near Dunfermline?
Yes, he worked in the Admiralty Dockyard of Rosyth, which refitted and looked after naval ships in the Forth. It had been very important in the First World War. And so my dad worked on the tugs there, and I was brought up in Dunfermline, which is only about 3 miles away. And there was no, I didn't come from a family that had any aspirations in that regard. I mean, I was, like everybody else, I think, supposed to grow up, go into an office for a couple of years, and then get married and have a family. That's what everybody did. Mm. But for some reason, my Liverpool mother got in the way, and it all became a bit more different. I mean, my only brother is a sculptor, and he lives in Canada. So we were quite unusual, I think, for that working class community. But I'm very proud of my West Fife roots indeed. And especially from about the people who taught me the songs. John Watt, who's sadly died now, was the person who ran the folk club in Dunfermline. He taught me songs and pointed me in the direction of learning songs, and the aforementioned Archie Fisher, who became really my mentor. Mm. So I was singing folk music right up to 1974 when I met Willie Russell. And Willie Russell, of course, was a great devotee of folk music. So that's another connection between me and Willie. And I met him through the folk scene, and he wrote a play and he said, "Would you like to sing these Beatles songs in my in my play?" So I went to the Liverpool Everyman Theatre, and really the rest was history, basically. That was it. That's when I changed from an itinerant folk music performer who'd been all over the place, sung everywhere, went to the Flas in Clare, travelled across Ireland, had lots of friends in Dublin who were musicians, and the people in Scotland, people in England, all over. Travelled on my own with a guitar, passed Billy Connolly on the railway platform at Doncaster Station. Mm-hmm. All these things, you know, are all part of my story.
So, of course, and many people know of Willie Russell, the great playwright and writer, for instance, of Blood Brothers. So, in a sense, Barbara, by getting those roles in Willie's plays, did that take you down a route, I suppose, of stardom that you didn't necessarily want to go, that you would have been just as happy to stay in the folk scene?
Well, John Paul George, Ringo and Bert, which was 1974, it was Willie's play about the Beatles. Remember, the Beatles had only really split up 4 years before that. So it was very new and raw and current still in Liverpool. And this was a Liverpool playwright writing a play seen from the standpoint of everyone who was left behind and didn't become successful. How could I resist, even as a person who'd never been in the theatre in my life? How could I resist being in that and singing and playing the songs? And actually, I had to play the piano in that show because nobody could play the piano. Nobody could make any noise. There was only three in the band. So I really was creatively, that's the word, tempted by doing that. Then, of course, I became a pop star. I was a pop star for 10 years, from 75 to 85. And then, ever since 1985, I've tried to, in a dignified fashion, she says in inverted commas, trying to sort of gone back to doing, you know, 20th century songs I like. I write songs, not many, but I do traditional music, songs that mean something to me. So I'm not at all upset about the fact that I was a pop star, because if I hadn't been a pop star, not so many people would be interested in what I do. They say, "Oh, I know who that is." And that is very useful.
And Barbara.
I was just going to say, but the thing is that people take a snapshot of you in a way. You know, they take a snapshot of somebody that they saw maybe on the Two Ronnies or something to do with, I know him so well, of course, and then they tend to think that's what you are. But the Two Ronnies was 1976, and I Know Him So Well was 1985. So it's a long time ago, you know, a very long time. My 33-year-old son wasn't even born then.
So does that become like an albatross, or as you get older, do you look back with fondness at that time?
Well, I think in Ireland it is a bit of an albatross, because actually because I don't do a massive amount in the south of Ireland. I mean, I was in Derry and I was in Belfast last year playing at both at things there, which were really interesting. But and I have you know, I have great memories of playing in Ireland, but I don't play very much, certainly not in, in Dublin. The last concert I did was in Dunleary about 4 years ago, and that was terrific. I played in the theatre there. But I don't think people associate me very much with playing live, which is a bit of a shame, because over here it's a totally different story.
Well, you mentioned there, Barbara, you do write some songs, and I'm just going to, we have one of your songs. We're going to play a little snippet now, which is Winter Song.
Yes, I didn't write that song. It was written by Alan Howell, who was the singer in Lindisfarne.
Okay.
Remember Lindisfarne?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so Winter Song was his song, but I recorded it very early in my career because I loved it. And it's on my own winter album from about 3 or 4 years ago, because I made a whole album of songs about this season.
It's really lovely. Let's have a little listen to it now, just
a
short bit of it.
When winter shadowy fingers first pursue you down the street, and your boots no longer lie about the cold around your feet, do you spare one thought for summer whose passage is complete? Whose memories lie in ruins, and whose ruins lie in heat, when winter comes.
And of course, Barbara, you have, and you are, because at the end I'm going to play a beautiful song, Jerry Rafferty's, of course, Baker Street, your adaptation of it. But you had a good relationship, didn't you, with Jerry Rafferty?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, Jerry wasn't actually a folk musician. I'm sorry, I don't wish to be pedantic, but he sort of came out of pop music and found himself accidentally in the folk scene via Billy, because Billy was making success in the folk scene with a guy called Tam Harvey, and they were the Humble Bums. So Jerry joined Billy and found himself in the folk scene, but he was always like a sort of, you know, you couldn't categorise him as a folk musician. But I got to know him, luckily, because he was in that scene. And he used to ask me to sing on his albums. I mean, I'm on City to City and Snakes and Ladders and Night Owl, which are his earliest, most successful albums. And also I got him to sing on an album of mine that I made of covers of Bob Dylan songs. And he was just remarkable. I mean, he was such a great writer and a dear and wonderful person. Very sort of deep and kind of troubled in a way, as a lot of artists are. But a wonderful person, very twinkly, very naughty. And I loved him dearly. And when he died in 2011, and it's just past the anniversary of his death, I always think about him with great fondness and profundity in a way. And when I made my album of covers of Jerry Rafferty's music, I thought perhaps it would sort of start a real, you know, a real sort of surge of interest in him once he'd gone. But sadly, that hasn't really happened. I mean, the people who loved him still love him. And somebody said to me the other day, you should do a volume two of that because there are more songs. But I haven't done it yet. But I think about him all the time. I have a picture of him that I keep very dear, very close to me. And also he has, through his family, he had massive folk roots, because his dad was from the North Antrim coast and who'd come over to the west of Scotland, like many Irish people did. And so he wrote a lot about, you know, his family. There's a great song called Steamboat Row, which was about a street they used to live in. And so his very, very much Irish Catholic roots show up in this man from Paisley. The same as Billy, really, in a way.
Well, look, Barbara, thanks so much. We're going to go out listening to you singing Gerry Rafferty's Bakersfield. But just to remind people, the great news is you're coming to Dublin as part of Tradfest. You and your pianist, Nick Holland, for a special acoustic show. And it's at the Pepper Canister Church here in Dublin on Saturday, the 25th of January. Tickets from tradfest.ie. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Barbara Dixon.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Miriam.
And we'll go out listening to you singing Gerry Rafferty's Baker Street.
Lovely.
Street, lining your head and dead on your feet. Well, another crazy day. You drink the night away and forget about everything. The city desert makes you feel so cold. It's got so many people, but it's got no soul. And it's taken you so long to find out you were wrong when you thought it held everything. You used to think that it was so easy. You used to say that it was so easy. But you're trying now. Another year and then you'd be happy. Just one more year and then you'd be happy. But you're crying now.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number 51551. You can also email Miriam at rt.ie. Well, historic, it's a word that's often misused in the context of events on this island of ours. But yesterday in Belfast, it was an historic occasion when eventually, after a breakdown of 3 years, Northern Ireland's politicians got together and the Assembly finally got back up and running. Coming so soon after the major row here in the south about commemorating the RIC and the DNP, it puts into sharp focus once again our history and how it should be commemorated. Well, to discuss both of these events, I'm now joined on the line by the wonderful Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Paul Muldoon, who's in London, and the great historian and broadcaster Eamon Phoenix, who's in Belfast. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Miriam.
Good morning.
I'll start with you, Paul. First of all, funny enough, our own Tommy Gorman, when writing a great piece about yesterday, he actually cited your poem, Paul, The Sightseers, talking about, you know, how important that poem was and how important yesterday was. What do you think the significance of yesterday is, Paul?
Well, I think it's fabulous news. I mean, one's only regret is that it has taken so long for the politicians who represent us to come to their senses and to realize that they must indeed represent us. But one doesn't necessarily want to dwell on that. I'm thrilled that they're back again talking to each other. And I hope, by the way, that as we continue along this new road, that we'll actually be privy to their conversations. It strikes me that far too much happens in the smoke, perhaps not the smoky room anymore, but in the back room somewhere. And I do believe that their conversation should be absolutely public. We need to know exactly what they're saying. We know, of course, that deals have to be done with a certain amount of circumspection. But I think we deserve to know what, in fact, they are saying to each other.
Eamon, put into context, as an historian, the importance of yesterday.
Well, I think it's very important. I mean, 3 years ago when Stormont collapsed, there was an atmosphere of dysfunctionality. The RHI scheme was a massive scandal at the time, so has been subject to a sworn inquiry since. And there was a sheer lack of trust between the two big parties, a sense that people were being disrespected by Stormont. Ministers were, you know, making decisions on their own. That, for example, one DUP minister withdrew a grant for the Irish language. And that, in fact, was a key catalyst to things collapsing. It seemed to be they were moving towards a shared out future rather than the shared future, which had been the vision of the Good Friday Agreement. But I think the 3 years since has seen the chastening of both the DUP and Sinn Féin. Their wings were trimmed in the recent election. They both suffered erosion of their core vote. You have this huge surge of young people who are voting now for the middle ground parties, almost becoming a third estate in the Northern Ireland political system. And then you have the crisis about the health service. You know, these huge waiting lists. You have the nurses' strike putting massive pressure on politicians right over the Christmas. And, of course, education is another major issue. So people are concerned about bread and butter issues. They had to deal with things like the Irish language because it had become an equality issue. And the great thing about the statements yesterday by Arlene Foster, the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, the Deputy First Minister, is that both parties are supporting the entire package, regardless of critics on each side. The Orange Order has criticised the DUP. There are some Irish language extremists criticising Sinn Féin. But they're prepared to step forward and recommend this as a way forward. And I think this will be a short mandate. We have 2 years. It's overshadowed by Brexit, which has been quite toxic here. But I think there has to be hope that we'll have real politics, real engagement, and a kind of consensual approach to, you know, very, very urgent issues.
And as I said at the beginning, Paul, Tommy Gorman cited your poem, The Sightseers, and you might recite it for us, Paul, but tell us about this poem first.
Well, this is a poem that's based, for what it's worth, on a family story. So it's based on a, quote-unquote, a true story. It was lore in our family as I growing up as a kid, and it refers to that particular division of the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the second division, the famous B specials, not to be confused with the A specials. In fact, I once met someone who claimed to have been an A special, but in any case, the B specials. And they were notable, I fear, for bad behaviour, I think it has to be said. And in the midst of all this, I think we mustn't forget that there has been a bit of bad behaviour in our history, and we shouldn't be drawing a veil or indeed a rug over it. But in any case, this is a little snapshot of a moment from my family's history, the Sightseers. My father and mother, my brother and sister and I, with Uncle Pat, our door best loved uncle, had set out that Sunday afternoon in July in his broken down Ford, not to visit some graveyard, one died of shingles, one of fever, another's knees turned to jelly, but the brand new roundabout at Ballygolly, the first in Mid Ulster. Uncle Pat was telling us how the B specials had stopped him one night somewhere near Ballygolly and smashed his bicycle and made him sing the sash and curse the Pope of Rome. They held a pistol so hard against his forehead there was still the mark of an O when he got home.
It's a beautiful poem, Paul. In the context, Eamon, of the row that's been going on this island, and I know, Eamon, you're part of the advisory committee to our Taoiseach on commemorations. What do you make of what happened about the RIC? I mean, there's been lots of great pieces written in the past week about, is there still a hierarchy of victims? Are we still not able to commemorate or remember? What's your take on it, Eamon?
Well, I think we've done very well, North and South, in remembering the decade over the last sort of 5 or 6 years. I mean, everyone knows Irishmen of both traditions died in the Great War. I've spoken on the Shankill Road and the Loyalist communities about the Easter Rising. We have had, you know, commemorations. And we have a rule in the North that if you have an exhibition on, say, something like the Great War or some aspect of nationalism or unionism, it must be able to travel to the other side of that invisible divide to get funding. We stick to the facts, we reflect different narratives, and things were going very well. And for example, the state celebration of the Easter Rising, which is seen as the forms at Origo off the modern Republic of Ireland, went very well. The Great War went very well. And earlier things in the North, like Carson's Army, which could have been very divisive and dragged us back, went very well. But inevitably, there are sensitivities about this. And I mean, I think the problem was with the RIC. We all, certainly people of my generation, remember old RIC families. They were seen, the local sort of ancestors, seen as the village Bobby wherever he served, and all of that memorabilia and folk memory. But nonetheless, the RIC was very much pitted against by Lord George Doyle-Ellen. They suppressed the Doyle. They were seen by people like Edmund de Valera, in his words, as the Janissaries of English rule in Ireland. And of course, they fought the IRA. And in that sense, of course, we had a minister saying that, for example, they had been murdered in the course of duty. That raised problems then. What was the status of the volunteers who were supposed to be the military wing of Dáil Éireann? So I think it reminds us that some things should be celebrated by the state in a major commemoration. Some things are best left to exhibitions, to academic conference, to local things. And I think there are lessons to be learned from this particular unfortunate episode, which has had negative resonances in the north as well as in the south.
Because I think, Paul, isn't it, we're a complicated people, and a lot of people over the past week were talking about, even within their own wider family, or, you know, there were people involved in both sides. How do we get it right as we go, I suppose, towards the Civil War even? How do we get the balance right of what we commemorate and who we commemorate? Paul? I think Paul's just going to, Eamon, I'll put that question to you because Paul's line's just gone down.
I think this is it. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, the RIC were part of the fabric of Irish history. 80,000 Irishmen passed through their ranks over almost a century. They served in barracks from Antrim to Cork. There were 75% of them, at least, from a Catholic farming background. So you had men from West Cork serving on the Shankill Road and vice versa. And they were that all-Ireland force and institution, as popular as any peace force is ever likely to be. But they did have this paramilitary side. They were seen as the eyes and ears of British rule in Ireland, and that's always going to be controversial. When, you know, the memory of the Irish Civil War, while it's largely, you know, banished now, but it still survives, particularly in some areas, and that will be a challenge to the political class and historians and the rest over the next couple of years.
And Paul, as an artist, as a great poet, I just lost you there. So to repeat the question, how do we, as we go forward, I ask you this finally, Paul, do we get the balance right? In other words, is there a hierarchy of victims? How do we reconcile the fact that even people's families had a lot of divisions with them going right back? How do we get a commemoration of the Civil War right? How do we do that going forward?
Well, actually, my apologies that there's something happened on the line there, but, yeah. You know, I'm fascinated by our moving in and out of two terms in this discussion. And one is to remember. And the other is to commemorate. Mm. And I think there's a nice distinction between those two. You know, as we remember, let's say, World War II, just to take it slightly out of this discussion for the moment, you know, we commemorate a number of things in that regard, but we probably don't commemorate the Nazis. We remember them, because partly because we don't want to go back there. So we, I think, have a responsibility to honor, of course, as you suggest, the complexity of things. But I don't necessarily believe that if we have two sides to an argument, say, that the truth resides absolutely between the two. And that's actually something that we in the broadcasting business have tended to believe. If you have an argument, you have someone who proposes it, someone who opposes it, and somehow the truth may not necessarily fall on either side. And that's a very nice idea, but I'm not sure if it absolutely applies. But as you say, the complexity of our lives in Ireland is one thing on which we can surely all agree. Anyone who suggests that any position is a cut-and-dried position or God's given position knows in their heart that that is just not the case. So I'd like to think that we move forward with a regard for that complexity and for the fact that we are able to live on this fabulous island at least for a few more years before the seas rise. And I think that's the thing that we should be mindful of, frankly, in the midst of it all. And my own image for this is that in that picture of the world where all the continents come back together again and the great super Gaia, whatever it's called.
Mm.
Actually, Ireland doesn't exist on that map. And I think that while we have that map in our minds, we need to honor what we have here and try to live in peace and understanding of one another.
Well, look, to you both, thanks so much for joining us this morning. And as you say, Paul and Eamon, on the basis of what happened yesterday, that sounds like it's good news for all of us here in this island going forward. My thanks today on sound to Gar Duffy. Laura Lee Davis was our BCO. Shanna Gorman produced. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, have a really lovely day. Agus slán.